Shalom, and thank you for listening at BethEmmanuel.org. We are often asked how people become members of our virtual congregation. We know that hundreds of people use our website and download our audio content, but most of them remain anonymous users. Others, however, reciprocate by becoming regular donors to Beth Emmanuel. We consider those people as virtual members of the community. If we have become your long-distance community, please consider supporting Beth Emmanuel by clicking on the Donate tab at BethEmmanuel.org.
Have you ever been in this perspective where you felt like, I have to know all the answers from the outset? Maybe you know people like this, maybe you're like this, where you just like have a million questions. You ever feel like you have to know all the answers, like you need to be able to explain everything? For some people, this is a real killer, you know? There's nothing wrong with wanting to know, to understand, and to learn. That's the natural curiosity about the way things work. We should be curious. I mean, you want to be, if you're not interested, you don't have questions, there's something wrong. That's a sign of disinterest. So questions are a very good thing. You know, for example, I have a son who takes things apart because he wants to know how they work. He takes them apart, and so, you know, sometimes he can put them back together again, and they still work. So that's a good thing. That's a natural inborn curiosity that we have. And if we're not curious enough about life and the universe and everything, we're not. It's like the unexamined life. You know, it's not worth living, they say. Anyway. It can become a problem. For some people, this becomes an obsession that can actually, rather than build our faith, it can erode our faith. You know, you can obsess over a question, usually something that can never have a satisfactory answer, such as the problem theodicy of the way that God, you know, runs the universe in the face of evil and suffering. How could a good God, you know, or, you know, for the less sophisticated maybe, it could be said, can God make a rock so big he can't lift it? You know, these sorts of questions are just racking my brain, trying to go back and forth with it. Or maybe it's something more personal. Maybe it's something a lot more personable, like, why would God do this to me? What did I do? How could he let this happen to me? Or maybe it's a question of the future, like, well, I just don't know where this is going. What's going to happen next? Where is God taking this? You know, is this going to turn? How's this going to, where does this end? What's next? And there's a good side of that. Maybe it's anticipation and hope. And there's a bad side, which is fear and apprehension. Well, today in the Torah portion, we read a story about a man going on a journey. And to where he was going, he did not know. The man, of course, was Avraham Avinu, Abraham our father, who is called the father of all who believe. And we learn that in Romans chapter 4, verse 11, which you will find on page 941 of the English Standard Version in the Pew Bibles, if you want to look at that with me. But while you're turning there, I'll just read you the passage that begins our Parsha, which we heard this morning chanted from the Bima so beautifully, the beginning of Lech Lecha, where the Torah tells us a story of how Abraham, God calls to Abraham, and he says, now the Lord said to Avram, go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you, and I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your great name so you will be a blessing, and I will bless those who bless you, and him who dishonors you I will curse, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. So Avram went as the Lord had told him. And in a sense, this Genesis 12 is where the book of Genesis really gets started. Everything up until this point, Adam and Eve, Cain and Abel, Enoch and Noah, the flood and Babel, all of that has only been background information, quickly narrated, a prelude to take us into the main story, which is the story of the family of Abraham. For that matter, the rest of the Bible, from Genesis 12 on to the end, is going to be the story of the family of Abraham. The story of Abraham's children, his seed, and how these promises that are made in Genesis 12 are being fulfilled. That's the whole thing, you know. So at Genesis 12, those first couple of verses, like the setup for all that follows. Abraham is the first forefather of the Jewish people, that is the nation of Israel, as the apostles explain. Abraham is the ancestor also of the singular seed, the Messiah, through whom all families on earth will be blessed. And therefore, as we learned in Galatians, Abraham is reckoned the father of all who believe on the promise of the seed of Abraham, the Messiah. And for that reason, according to Paul, he is the father of faith. And we may say, and we may pray, whether Jewish or Gentile, you may say these words, Abraham, our father, Avraham Avinu. He is the father of both the Jewish people and the God-fearing Gentile disciples of the Messiah. So this is the point he's making here in Romans 4 when he says, he was the father of all who believe without being circumcised, so that righteousness would be counted to them as well, and to make him the father of the circumcised, who are not merely circumcised, but also walk in the footsteps of the faith that our father Abraham had before he was circumcised. Now, from this passage, the critical thing that we learn here in regard to paternity, our paternity, is not whether or not we are physically descendant from Abraham. For example, the Ishmaelites could also make that claim, as could the Edomites. The Ishmaelites are the Arab world today claims to be descended from Ishmael. So all the entire Arab world also can say Avraham Avinu, if they say it in Hebrew. I don't know how to say it in Arabic. But the point is not physical descent. The critical thing from Paul's perspective is this question. Are you walking in the footsteps of Abraham's faith? I have this memory when I was a boy, about 9 years old or so, I was visiting my brother up in, he was stationed at Finland Air Base and Air Force Base up in Finland, Minnesota. And I was just, you know, at that age, I was looking up to my, you know, he had my 19, 20-year-old brother. He's an airman. And I was just wanted to be like him. And we're walking through the snow, and he's had these long legs. We'd be taking these long strides. And I remember trying to match those strides, like see if I could plant my feet in his footsteps, actually his boot steps in the snow, you know, not because I couldn't cut 6 inches of snow myself, but because I just wanted to be him. I wanted to be him, and so I was like literally going to walk in his footsteps, which is kind of the idea here. What does it mean when we say Abraham is our father, the father of our faith, the father of all who believe, and how do we walk in his footsteps? Well, I'd like to look at it from a philosophical perspective. If we call Abraham our father, it's not much different than when we say Archimedes, for example, is the father of, tell me, math, mathematics, all right? Or Galileo is the father of astronomy, yeah. Or Newton is the father of physics, yes, okay. All right, so I mean, that's not to say that no one ever studied or practiced mathematics before Archimedes, or that there was nobody who observed the stars or did astronomy prior to Galileo, or that there was no one who ever noticed apples dropping from trees prior to Newton. But these men impacted their respective fields so much so that they changed them forever, and they defined them thereafter. And this is true of Abraham. He is the father of our faith in that he impacted our faith and changed it and shaped its course and defined its quality henceforth. How did he do this? Well, for one thing, he revealed monotheism. I mean, sure, everybody believes in the gods. We all believe in gods. We worship gods. Abraham has this idea. He says, I think there's only one God. Okay, so that was a big deal. Now, it's not that he was the first monotheist. There were probably other monotheists before him. Monotheism had a brief run in Egypt, didn't it? With Amenhotep, and I think it was. And Akhenaten, Akhenaten. And many tribal cultures have a monotheistic core when you strip back all that animism and spiritism, and they'll say, no, okay, there really is one divine spirit that's the source of all things. So, monotheism was running among Native Americans, so it's not like he was the only monotheist, but he brought monotheism as revelation. So according to the legends, it started philosophically for Abraham with the sun and the moon. As a three-year-old child, he's out. He sees the sun and the moon. He thinks, the moon must be God. And he sees the sun chase the moon out of the sky, saying, no, the whatever. You got that. You know, see, he's reasoning it. He's reasoning it through. Then he sees, wait a second, there must be a God who made both of these. Monotheism. So he comes to it rationally in his own mind. This is in the legend. The Midrash Rabbah says, Abraham was like a man walking in the night. He saw a palace full of lights. And he says to himself, surely there is not a palace full of lights that does not have an owner and a resident. Reasoning this way, he saw the stars and he saw the nighttime sky. And he said, surely somebody created all this and set all of this in motion. So he reasons it out. He comes to these conclusions himself. But then there's the stories about his defiance of Nimrod, how he refused to compromise. He even was willing to sacrifice his life and be thrown into the fiery cauldron for his convictions. But I don't know if you noticed that none of these stories made the final cut of the Bible. Why? Because the Bible's story of Abraham's faith does not start with Abraham thinking about the sun and the moon and coming to a logical conclusion of monotheism by the capacity of human reason. The Bible's story about Abraham completely passes over all of that in silence. You might say that the Bible's story does not begin with Abraham, rather it begins with Hashem. As the holy martyr Stephen put it in Acts chapter 7, he said, the God of glory appeared to our father Abraham when he was in Mesopotamia, before he lived in Haran, and said to him, go out from your land. So the vision of Abraham begins in the Bible with something hyper-rational. Something completely subjective, a vision, a revelation, a communication from the supernatural. God initiated it. And this is something true about faith. We're learning about faith, right? We're learning about biblical faith. And this is one of the principles of biblical faith. God starts it. It did not and does not start with us. Now you might say to yourself, wait a second. When is the last time that God appeared to me and said something to me? You know, he's never appeared to me in a vision. He's never done anything. You might say, he's never done a single thing to indicate his existence. He could have called. He could have sent a letter. Anything. You know, just a small thing. Drop by just for coffee or something, you know, something. Reveal yourself in some capacity. So how can you say that, if that's the case, how can you say that he initiated my faith? Fair enough, you know. Sometimes he does that stuff, you know. Sometimes he doesn't. For example, I like to tell this story. I read about a Muslim man who wanted to find out about Yeshua. So he's reading the Injil, which is what that's like the Arabic word for the gospel, you know? So he's reading the Injil, and he comes to Luke chapter 3, where it tells about the Holy Spirit descending upon the master in the form of a dove as he comes up out of the Jordan. All of a sudden, the windows in the room that he's sitting blow open, and a stormy wind comes in, and he hears a voice say to him, an audible voice says, I am Jesus Christ, whom you hate. I am the Lord, whom you are looking for. Wow. That guy became a believer. That's a God-initiated faith. You might even call that an unfair advantage. Or alternatively, a hallucination. In any case, a subjective experience. But for most of us, we don't experience anything that dramatic. Maybe nothing at all. And here's the funny thing. Nothing is actually normal. But it's still God initiated. That is the whole point of saying that we are sons of Abraham, children of Abraham's faith. It's not that God initiated this faith with each one of us personally in the same manner that he did with Abraham, but that he did so with Abraham, and that the revelation that God delivered to Abraham has been passed on to us through the vehicle of Abraham's family, which is called the Jewish people. So the Jewish people have passed on that initial faith experience of Abraham, which became the faith of Abraham. And they followed their father's faith, and eventually what they did was they started to write stuff down. They wrote the scriptures, and over many centuries and across many lands and across many peoples and time, the story of Abraham's faith spread to you, to each one of us. So God initiated your faith, as Stephen says, when the God of glory appeared to our father Abraham. The story of Abraham, however, is not just a story about God's revelation to him. It is primarily a story about man's response to revelation. It's not as if God appeared to Abraham and said, "Abraham, I am the one true God. I exist. Believe in me." That wasn't the revelation. Who wouldn't believe in God if he appeared and said, "Believe in me"? I'd believe in him. Instead, God appeared to Abraham and starts giving him instructions and telling him how to run his life. Same thing happens at Mount Sinai. Biggest moment in history. God interrupts the whole program as if he's cutting in on it's like we interrupt this program for a message from our Creator. He interrupts everything. He descends on Mount Sinai. What does he do? Naturally he should. There should be some maybe some like, "Let me explain. I'm a spiritual being." None of that. He just immediately starts doing number one, number two, number three. "I got 10 things to say." It's just like he starts laying down laws. By the time he's done, there's 613. But he starts telling you how to run your life, how to obey, and that's what revelation is. And this is an important lesson of faith. We're learning about faith, by the way. Turn to Hebrews chapter 11, which you can find on page 1007 of the English Standard Version. We're learning about faith, the book of faith and hope, as the writer of the book of Hebrews, beginning with Parsha Bereshit, we learned a couple weeks ago, he was bringing us through a list of heroes of the faith who left a witness to faith in God, a witness of assurance of things hoped for, and a conviction of things not seen. And so far, who have we learned? We learned Abel, Enoch, and Noah. Last week we did Noah. It was Parshat Noach. Today we're going to start to learn Abraham. And the very first thing he teaches us about Abraham is that Abraham's faith is more than just belief. He says in verse 8, "By faith, Abraham obeyed." You would expect from a more evangelical perspective that it should say, "By faith, Abraham believed." But he says, "By faith, Abraham obeyed when he was called to go out to a place that he was to receive an inheritance." So the point of Abraham's faith is not merely believing, but the Abraham story is a story, as you know, of faith tested. The sages say that Abraham endured 10 trials of faith. That's what it says in Pirkei Avot. And there are at least two different enumerations of what the 10 trials were. But the point is that Abraham endured test after test. And when he passed one test, then it led to the next. So if Abraham is the father of all who believe, then we, as we live out our faith, we can expect to undergo testing too. And in fact, everything in life could be called a test. You like tests. They come as true and false tests. True and false. Choose truth. choose the true answer. They come as multiple choice tests. Make the right decision. They come as fill-in-the-blank tests. Wisdom, insight, knowledge, the fear of the Lord, the knowledge of God. Fill in the blank. And everybody's favorite, they come as essay questions. Write his word upon the doorposts of your homes and on your gates and on your mind and on your heart. And as James, the brother of the master, taught us, count it all joy, my brothers, when you meet tests of various kinds. Okay, James, we'll count that joy. Abrahamic faith, the point is, Abrahamic faith is not just revelation. It is, here, we'll make that, this will be a soundbite. I'll say it like in a soundbite way. Abrahamic faith is not just revelation, but man's response to revelation. That's good. I like that. Do that again. I think Paul has a similar thing happening back in Romans chapter 4, where we were just a minute ago, to Romans chapter 4, when he spoke of those who walk in the footsteps of Abraham's faith. In other words, according to Paul, we are supposed to be emulating Abraham, and as regards faith and living it out, he's our role model. And so I believe that Paul learned this principle that what does it mean? What does that mean to walk in Abraham's footsteps? What does it mean that Abraham is the father of our faith? I believe he learned this directly from Yeshua of Nazareth. Well, not directly from Yeshua of Nazareth, but he learned this directly from the words of Yeshua of Nazareth, who taught this very simple principle. If you were Abraham's children, you would be doing the works Abraham did. John 8:39. Very beautiful, simple principle. So it becomes necessary from this perspective to pursue the faith of Abraham, and it's not something you passively acquire or inherit. It is something, in fact, you must do, and there is a doing aspect to this faith, doing the works that Abraham did. That's what the master says. What are the works that Abraham did? Well, we could enumerate the 10 trials. We might consider the stand that he took against idolatry in his world, or his willingness to sacrifice his life for his convictions. Or we might consider his positive examples, his extravagant hospitality that he showed to strangers. Or we could consider his unhesitating obedience. He rose up very early in the morning and split the wood for the offering. We could consider his resolute steadfastness and confidence in the promises of God. We could consider his love for peace, his willingness to undergo personal loss and sacrifice. Hey, Lot, why don't you just take whatever part of the land you want? We could consider his devotion to his wife, who he never abandoned, although she was barren. We might consider his reputation as an evangelist, or his compassion for human beings. We might consider how he repaid ingratitude with devotion, how he risked his life to save his own family members. He gave a tithe. He was a tither, giving envelopes in the back. Or how he refused to take the reward of the wicked, negotiating with God on behalf of the wicked. He says to the king of Sodom, I won't even take a shoestring from you. And then a couple chapters later, he's praying for the survival of the people of Sodom. We might consider his accepting circumcision at the age of 100 years old, Hine, or the last trial, the sacrifice of Isaac, which we read in the next parsha. So I guess you could say there is a lot
to the story of Abraham.
In other words, many, many lessons that can be derived from Abraham's stories. In the book of Hebrews, we read, "By faith, Abraham obeyed when he was called to go out to a place that he was to receive as an inheritance. And he went out, not knowing where he was going." So, you ask God, you say, where's this thing going? where does this end? You know, maybe life ever feel like a roller coaster? You know, it's like anticipation, and disappointment. fear, dread, anxiety. So some people enjoy roller coasters. They pay money to get on those, you know? Some people, they say, like, I don't want to get on the roller coaster. I need to know where it's going to go. I want to know how high the Stevens drop. You know, I don't want to get on something unpredictable. I don't want to be frightened. I want to know every step of this thing before I undertake it. And faith just doesn't work that way. When the father of faith set out on the journey of faith, he didn't even know where he was going. That's what it says. He did not know where he was going. If I need to understand Hashem, and everything has to make sense to me before I am willing to undergo this journey of faith, this relationship of faith, then I'm putting the cart before the horse. Abraham didn't have all the answers before he responded in faith. This mindset is like that of a child. You say, go to bed. Why? Time for lunch. Why? I want to understand. I want to understand the digestive process of a human being and how long it takes before he needs to refuel. You know, I want to understand why I need to sleep. I don't understand. Do all mammals sleep? You know, kids. God is just like this. He's like, shake the lulav. Why? No, you take the palm branch and you take the citron. No, why? I want to know. Before I start shaking a palm branch, I want to know all the answers, right? I want to understand why would I have to do it. Well, how is that different? God says, keep the Sabbath. Why? Don't eat that crustacean. Why? Be faithful to your spouse. Why? on and on and on and on. It's lessons for direction in life. You might not know all the whys or where God is leading you. That's just part of faith. What did Kierkegaard say? He said, life must be lived forward, but can only be understood backwards. The same thing works with the mitzvahs. Same thing works with faith. Faith must be lived forward. You don't understand it before undertaking it. So we read here in verse 9, by faith he went to live in the land of promise as in a foreign land, living in tents with Isaac and Jacob, heirs with him of the same promise. What is the apostle trying to say here? Of course we know Abraham lived in a tent. He was nomadic. And of course we know that he lived in a land that he did not own, that God had only promised to give him this land as an inheritance. That's why it's called the promised land, right? So what is he trying to tell us here? Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob lived in a land that God had promised to give them, right? And he never did give it to them. He promised to give it to their children. He promised it to their seed. As we read in the Torah portion today, it said in the Torah portion, I am the Lord who brought you out of Ur, of the Chaldeans, to give you this land. And Abraham said, how will I know? And then Hashem said, as for yourself, you're going to go to your fathers in peace. You'll be buried at a good old age, but your seed will come back here in the fourth generation. That was in Genesis 15. So what's the point of stating the obvious? Only to say this. Abraham
lived in a land that was not his own. And yet he was sure of what he hoped for. The promised land. Its faith. He was convinced of it, even though in his own lifetime, he never saw it come to pass. And this is the big, heavy lesson for today. Has it ever occurred to you that you might never see the fruit of your faith in your lifetime? Has it ever occurred to you that you might live your whole life for a promise you will never, ever receive in this life? No, we're not talking about the next life. The next life is another story. I'm talking about this life. That's what Abraham did. That's what Isaac and Jacob did too. Why? They did it for their children and for the future and for future generations and ultimately for us and all the families of the earth and finally for the whole human species. If they had not, we would not be here talking about this today. And they would not be the fathers of our faith. I can compare this to living your entire life preparing for the coming of the Messiah, though he may tarry, and he certainly does. And if my life and your life goes anything at all like the lives of all the disciples of Yeshua that have believed in him and have ever lived in the last 49 generations since he promised to be back within a generation, I will die without having seen that hope realized. And so will you. Yet, as Rambam says, I await him every day. That's the lesson. So we learn from Abraham, the father of our faith, that living in faith means sometimes living in that place of tension between promise and expectation, and the disappointing experience of reality. I would go so far as to say this is the real proof of faith. Where the rubber meets the road, the proof of the pudding, and whatever other similes there are and idioms and metaphors. Unwavering, undoubting confidence and certainty in the face, not of success. Who isn't psyched up to be full of faith when God's blessing you with abundant success? What about in the face of disappointment? I'm not talking about denial. I'm not talking about I see, it's all good, it's all good, everything's good. I'm talking about, it's bad, and I still believe, and I still have faith, and I still am steadfast in confidence. The writer of the book of Hebrews explains how Abraham could do this. How can you do this? How could Abraham live in a land his entire life that God had promised to give him, and yet he doesn't own any of it at all? He even has to buy a piece of property to bury his own wife in this land that was it's promised to him. The writer of the book of Hebrews explains in verse 10, "For he was looking forward to the city that has foundations, whose designer and builder is God." City of God. I don't know what Augustine meant by that. I never read his book. But I know what the writer of the book of Hebrews means. With those words, the apostle opens the Abraham story up to its final and ultimate conclusion, which is the Messianic era. Messianic Jerusalem, and the world to come, the final consummation in New Jerusalem. And this is where the text here in Hebrews, in my mind, this is where it starts to get really good and really interesting. And I'd like to learn more about it. We'll have to learn more about it maybe next week or maybe in future weeks. But for now, we learned just a few simple lessons. Number one, we learned a few simple lessons about walking in the footsteps of Abraham. We learned that Abraham is the father of our faith because we are in the school of his faith. Just like every astronomer looks back to Galileo, every mathematician is working with equations developed by Archimedes. Number two, God initiated Abraham's faith by revelation. It is a revealed faith. It is not intuitive. You would not have come to these conclusions on your own. Number three, Abrahamic faith is not just revelation, but man's response to revelation. I like that. Number four, Abrahamic faith does the deeds that Abraham did. That's the way Yeshua put it. Number five, Abrahamic faith does not have all the answers. Abraham didn't even know where he was going. He knew what he was looking for, but he didn't even know where he was going. So it doesn't have to answer every question. Number six, Abrahamic faith endures and lives in the tension between promise and disappointment, between anticipation, expectation, and the current experience of reality. And it thrives there. And number seven, Abrahamic faith ultimately is about the future, the messianic age, and the world to come.